The mind does not pursue pain. What you avoid is pain, and what you pursue is pleasure. And so somehow they exalted pain-seeking as a spiritual pursuit. Heaven knows why. This is all over the world, not only the Christian martyrs and things like that, all over the world, in India, and in Buddhistic. Yeah?
Could it be just to realizing the attraction and repulsion and to overcome the conditioning? Would it be a false attempt to overcome conditioning?
Can I overcome conditioning by creating another conditioning? She likes chocolates. She can revolutionize that conditioning by eating chilies. 6 years later, she's got a bag full of chilies instead of chocolates. So what? What have I done? Nothing. I have not overcome conditioning as such. Conditioning cannot be overcome. This is the only unconditioned thing. The infinite consciousness is the only unconditioned being. All the rest of it is conditioned. Whether you condition yourself to what we here, the 20 of us here, have voted as virtue, or you condition yourself to what we, the 20 of us here, have voted to be wise, you are conditioned. That's no use at all. We'll come to that later. Now here we are not coming down at all. At present we are merely dealing with this fellow playing ball, the ball game on top. Without looking down at all, without looking within, he is merely hitting the ball, and the master or the authority or his parent merely suggests that instead of hitting the ball this way, which seems to come back and bang the back of your head, hit it this way so that it might, it may not come and hit you. It may not come and hit you where you may be hurt. That's all. Is that right? We are not talking about self-realization at all. We are merely dealing with the tricks that were introduced in order to make life as pleasant as possible. The ball is still going to come back, but when it hits you, let it be in a tickling way. Let it not knock your brains out. That's all. The reaction is not sought to be avoided now. We'll come to that later. The reaction is not sought to be avoided at all, but the reaction is sought to be a little nobler, a little happier, a little more blessed. We are seeking good fortune, not no fortune. That is tapas, austerity. But I think I feel what tapas really means is a natural, extremely simple life. And that is what I learned from Swami Shivananda. He did not indulge in all sorts of crazy forms of austerity. But a natural, simple life where there is no room for pursuit of pleasure, nor a masochistic love of pain. Simple, natural. I have never seen a person more naturally human than Swami Shivananda. I'll give you one example. We were in the All India tour, and we were in Baroda, and there was a public demonstration of devotion to the master. And in India this is a common occurrence. I think even Mataji performed once or twice. What is called Pada Puja. But you know how a deity is worshipped with flowers, with water, with milk and all sorts of things. We ask the master to keep his feet in a big bowl and wash his feet with chanting mantras and so on. And then worship the feet, his feet with flowers. This is done as a sort of routine, devotional practice. And they wanted to do, that is, for us, during that ceremony, this personality itself is God, divine. That's the idea. They were doing it at a public meeting in Baroda. Quite a number of very important persons were there, dignitaries of the place. And an enormous number of devotees. And in that part of India, they have also a peculiar custom. Everyone brings sandalwood paste, which might almost be running, and take it and then dab it on your forehead to keep you cool, I guess. This is another ceremony, another ritual, which they indulge in. And the master accepted all that. He sat down with his legs in the bowl. They started the ceremony. They offered some flowers and they put a garland around his neck. And then one by one, a few devotees came. They wanted to apply this sandal paste on his forehead. Somebody did it. It was fairly, solid. It stuck there. Somebody else did it. A few others. And then came another middle-aged woman. And her hands, she was terribly excited. She was terribly excited, I guess. And she dipped her fingers into her little bowl and started doing this. And this funny thing was running. And probably there was some kind of incense in it, which ran into the master's eyes, and the eyes started burning. What would you do? Please, visualize yourself sitting there. You are the greatest God Almighty there, and you are being worshipped by all these people who think that you are God. You would probably be tempted to, grin and bear it. Okay, they are full of devotion. Why must I? And they expect me to bear everything calmly, and I mustn't show any pain. Oh, no. I was sitting next to him. Hey, who is it? Who is it? Hey, ask it to go. Hey, just go. Chalaji. Go, go, go. Go. It is hurting. It's a natural reaction of the eyes to burn when something irritating is put into it. To grin and bear it is not called tapas, is not austerity. Look within and see what is it that demands that you should keep quiet in those circumstances. Your ego, me. The me which is frightened to lose its vanity. Blow it. It hurts. Say, oh, get up. We looked at somebody gave him a bowl of water. He washed his eyes. Achaji. Yeah, carry on. I saw nothing happened. I've never seen a more pure human being. One who was utterly human. With no pretensions at all. Whose actions and whose reactions were pure. Without leaving a mark, without leaving a residue, without leaving a vasana. Only Swami Shivananda. I've seen many others. Many others would some of you do this, especially ladies. While you're walking along the road, if there's a spider or something in your, an ant or something in your back, you don't do that. It's supposed to be unladylike. And so what do you do? Till you find a lady's room there. Why not take your... if it was Swami Shivananda, you would take all his clothes off and try to see, see what is this? That's it. Finished, put all your clothes on, walk on. That is what I call is natural, simple life. In that natural, simple life, if you want to introduce the word God here, you exist as God made you, and your life is as God willed it. No pretensions at all, no pretensions one way or the other. Then the next is dana, charity. Here again, there was a very well-intentioned approach to this doctrine of karma. They very carefully drew a distinction between what comes to you unsought, prosperity that falls into your lap, as it were, that is the fruit of your own past karma. That is, you are born in a wealthy family. Let's say, your father and your grandfather might have been great exploiters and great, that's black marketeers. You are not responsible for all that. You are born into the family and you found yourself a millionaire. They drew a distinction between that and unjust exploitation, which was forbidden, right? That was forbidden. You're not allowed to exploit unjustly. Anyayena arthasanjayana. That's the only sin. To exploit and acquire wealth is sinful. So avoid it. Because that's going to come back to you again as some other karma. But I am born into a wealthy family because of my own past karma. What do I do with it? Now I do charity. If you do good now, the good will return to you 100-fold, 1,000-fold. They didn't explain to you. They didn't wait for you to ask them. I am quite satisfied with being a millionaire. I don't want to become a multimillionaire. She is telling me that if you do charity of your million, it will come back to you as 10 million. I'm telling them I don't want. Let me keep the million. They didn't ask. They didn't wait till you asked that question. They said, now that you have it, spend it in charity so that you will eventually earn a place in heaven. That is a mistake again. A motivation is introduced here. Yeah, rather unhealthy motivation was introduced. So if I find out that there is no heaven, then I don't do charity either.
To go back a minute, how does one decide whether exploitation is just or unjust?
All exploitation, sorry, thank you. I should not have used unjust exploitation. All exploitation being unjust. Thank you. So, dana, charity was encouraged. While doing charity, you naturally reserve for yourself what you need, what you really need, and distribute to others what they need. Thus, your own selfishness, we are still talking beyond that, not the me. Your own gross selfishness is sort of thinned out a little bit. And at the same time, social welfare, social well-being is promoted. This also led to all sorts of corrupt practices, unfortunately. Right. Then the first, which is the last for us, sacrifice. I think this word is the most abused of the lot. Sacrifice, I believe, means to make something sacred. To make something sacred. It's a beautiful thing. I really don't know how and where the word assumed the significance of something being destroyed or killed. Sacrifice a lamb. Sacrifice. That's it. That was the ancient Kabbalistic idea, I believe. That when you kosher meat, as long as it is kosher, as long as you offer a prayer, say a prayer, and cut the throat of something, the power of your prayer and the fact that you are cutting it liberates the spirit. Purifies it, sacrifices it. What we are capable of. Fantastic people we are. What if a lion stands in front of me? May I purify you? Anyhow, that is the human, you asked me, what is the human mind? That is the human mind. If the human mind was not there, all these perverse doctrines wouldn't be born at all. So, at one stage you understand, the mind understands the perversity of the doctrine, and that's a good use. That is what seems to have been the idea. And let's get away from this sacrifice of animals. But that seems to have been the idea. That whatever I eat, whatever I consume, is a sacrifice unto God. So that even these are made pure, made holy. The Indian view of the sacrifice took a fivefold form. It is called Pancha Mahayajna. Pancha is five, Maha, great yajnas. In a couple of them you may not be interested. Deva Yajna, or worship of God, the daily worship of God was considered as a kind of sacrifice. When the food that they ate was also offered in sacrifice and taken as a sacrament. You have the Mass every Sunday, and you have a sacrament every Sunday. The Orthodox Hindu Brahmin was supposed to do it at least once a day, midday, every day. And no food was eaten in our houses without this worship being performed, and all the food being offered to God and taken as sacrament all the time. This also involved something else, that is, you are my wife and you have cooked the food, and before we eat, the whole food is offered in puja, offered to God, and then you are no longer involved in that. It's God's prasad that we are all eating. Now, I dare not say that there is no salt in it or there is no spice in it, that it is not well cooked, because then I am blaspheming against God. That suited these women. The husband was forbidden from grumbling. He quietly swallowed whatever he was given, because it's all God's prasad. Right. So that is Deva Yajna, daily worship of God. Pitri Yajna, or the adoration or sacrifice to the ancestors, took two forms: some ritual ceremonies and so on, and also leaving a son behind, so that they are pleased that our family tree is perpetuated. Deva Yajna, Pitri Yajna, Rishi Yajna, the sages, adoration of the sacrifice unto the sages. Sacrifice of my time and my talent to the sages. So that every day I studied the scriptures and recited them, taught them to others. These three probably are a bit far-fetched, most of you. And then came two others, which were Manushya Yajna, that is charity. Again, not charity of that type, but the, I think this is also in the Jewish tradition, that they always had one seat around the table. Yes? Empty. They're the unknown guest. And this was considered compulsory in those days, that nobody should eat without feeding an uninvited guest. A guest who happens to come be there. It need not be a poor man, it need be it may be anybody. Huh? Any traveler, any pilgrim, anybody who is walking along the road. After the meal, the lunch had been cooked, the head of the family would go to a temple or the riverside and see if somebody was sitting there, a stranger, and go and ask him, "Would you care to come and join us?" This is considered a must. Imagine a whole village of about 100 houses doing this. There should be no poverty, there should be no hunger or starvation at all. It's a beautiful system. Only that's it. I think that they forbade this tradition. And the last was even more interesting. I don't think, unless some of you have been to, not only to India, but to South India, you may not understand what I mean. Have you seen some kind of patterns drawn outside houses?
No, not in the ashram.
Not in the ashram, of course.
I've seen pictures of them.
Pictures of them, right. This is a delightful tradition which somehow got out of control again. Early in the morning, the lady of the house was supposed to take a handful of grains and throw it outside for the insects to eat. Yeah, that's right, correct, so that they may not come in the house, so that they may have it there and go away. And then they thought that instead of just throwing these handful of grains, why not make them a nice pattern? Looks nice, artistic. And afterwards it became a fine art. In South India, if you go to South India, in, especially in, December, January, you'll find this on every, in front of every house, an elaborate pattern with rice powder. Now they don't use rice powder, they use chemical powder. You know, right? The original purpose is lost, the original ideal is lost, then it becomes a mere artistic pattern. And then when it becomes an artistic pattern, you don't bother about the thing anymore. You use any powder.
In competition.
That's right. All sorts of things. And they used to throw that rice powder in various patterns for the insects to eat. And after the puja, after the ceremony, before the V8, we were also supposed to throw a ball of rice on the roof for the birds to eat. A ball of food, yes. And again, none of these things was purely unselfish. It would be wrong to paint it as absolutely unselfish. I also believe, this is, underhand information. this is not printed. This is the other thing is printed. That before you eat, you must take a ball of rice and give it to the crows and the birds. But I also believe that especially the crow would not touch the food if there was something poisonous in it. So it's a sort of self-protection. You throw it and wait till the crow eats it, and now you know that the food is edible. It's all right to eat it. Right, and after the meal was over, again we were supposed to feed the cows and so on, whatever is left. There is nothing to be, nothing was allowed to be preserved. Refrigerators were disallowed, leave alone didn't exist. They were disallowed. Because in the Gita you find, yatayamam gatarasam. One was not allowed to eat food which had been preserved for 3 hours. It was devitaminized and denatured food. No food that was cooked was allowed to be preserved for more than 3 hours. In our houses, our old women wouldn't even eat pickles because they're also preserved. We were given pickles. We liked it. But they wouldn't touch it. And when asked, why should I perform all these five sacrifices, they said that the performance of these five sacrifices does not earn any merit at all. You don't go to heaven by doing this. But it is to atone for the inevitable sins we commit every day. How is it so? They said, when you sweep the floor, you are killing some insects. When you walk, you are killing some insects. When you cook, you are killing some living beings. And to atone for these inevitable sins, you perform these fivefold sacrifices. Thus they tried their best to bring about some kind of a balance. In all these, if you observe very closely, if you do not provide the motivation of a heaven and that sort of thing, it is possible to thin out the craving for pleasure, to reduce the spirit of domination, the spirit of exploitation, to promote a certain piety of the heart, certain purity of the heart, certain amount of unselfishness, which is absurd, I know, but still. The grossness of selfishness is thinned out, worn out a little bit. You learn to see that you don't need all this. And by sharing with someone else what you have, you're really adding to the quantity of happiness or joy in the world, thereby increasing your own delight. All these were very subtly introduced into all this. Of course, it doesn't work so well. Nothing works till you come and face that, the me. Thank you.